Boop, beep, beep, boop. Catchy jingle? We need a catchy jingle.
Catchy jingle. This is the part where we put in the jingle. Snappy, snappy words and songs. Makes you want to buy these products. La, 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 la. You know it's a fun product?
What?
Socks.
Socks. Oh, my God. I mean, but who wears socks these days? Nobody wears socks.
A lot of people.
I don't believe it. Do not believe it. Oh, yeah? Name one.
There's a Venn diagram out there. If I did a Venn diagram of people who wear socks and people who like space, that little sliver in the middle of pure joy and happiness, that's sciencesocks.com right there.
Sciencesocks.com. Huh. Is there like a special link that people should go to?
Sure is. It's called sciencesocks.com/nerd. That's sciencesocks.com/nerd for all your socks and spacey nerdiness needs. And if you purchase anything from that URL, 10% of all proceeds go to STEM programs to help kids learn science.
Amazing. 10% of your purchase could be going to a STEM charity. Fantastic. I love it. Makes me happy.
All right, everyone. Hope you visit that shop. Enjoy, and many cozy footwearings to you.
You are listening to a Science Actually production. Shake it up. Shake it up.
Shake it up. Shake it up.
Unless we have banter.
A little chitty chitty.
Nobody's chat. Coming for the science.
Chitty chitty chat chat. Ah, I came out wrong. Chit chat.
We chitty chat. Chit chat. Yes.
Chitty chat. What's your name, chitty, chitty, bang, by bang. The way? Like, I'm sorry. You're Kobe's friend, right?
I'm Kobe's friend. That's actually my name.
Wow.
My parents named me Kobe's friend, and it was just by sheer luck I actually met a guy named Kobe, and we became friends. So that's kind of weird.
We've been searching for each other our whole lives, and I met this guy.
Yeah, I'm done now. That's it. My name.
Yeah, I said hi. My name's Covey, and he said, "Oh my God, I'm Covey's friend." I'm like, this is going to get awkward.
It was like that scene from the movie. Like, what does my tattoo say, dude? Mine says sweet.
It's exactly dude, sweet, dude, sweet.
My name's Benjamin.
Yeah,
and I'm Covey's bestie once a week for about an hour.
Where do you live? Where are you from?
I am just south of San Francisco.
Oh, okay. I'm from Dallas.
Oh, okay. There you go. Similar continent.
From the Australian perspective, those two are basically like the same area.
The same thing.
It's the U.S. at least.
It's the Southwest.
I'm gonna reach out my window right now and touch Dallas. Hold on.
We got all those American accents on this podcast.
And whatever weird Australian kind of mixed up accent I have from living overseas for a decade and having an American partner.
Yeah. Exactly. I don't get to hear American accents that much anymore, so they kind of stand out to me. I'm like, why do you sound normal?
All right.
And that's why we brought you on the show. Yeah. So welcome, everyone, to another episode of Science Actually Presents the Nerd and the Scientist. As we have just been discussing, I'm Covey, that's Benjamin, and we have brought an American guest to make Benjamin feel at home, and I guess vice versa, Courtney Crawford, who is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Sydney, which is also where I happen to be, by coincidence. Courtney works on stars in general, specifically pulsating stars, and our Corona Borealis stars, which are these very fascinating but also super weird stars, before you ask, not aliens. But yes, thank you, Courtney, for coming on the show and talking with us.
I'm just glad that you mentioned Arcoborealis, because normally I just get the pulsating stars. So I'm happy I got the second one. Hello, thank you for having me.
To be fair, Benjamin was the main driver to get you on the show because he wanted to know about starquakes. There are earthquakes and there are Mars quakes.
It was in the news quite a bit. Star quakes were happening and being detected or whatever. And I thought, oh, snap.
Do you mean in the sun or do you mean in another star?
On another star.
Because I don't actually know what you're talking about.
I don't know. I saw it. There's something about it. It was a while back when I read the article. And it's not my job to remember these things or discover these things or write these things or study these things. I'm the guy who reads the end result and goes, oh, neat. I'm going to talk to my astrophysicist friend about it.
Starquakes are like a thing that, starquakes are like a word we use in public communication to try to communicate a concept that is really foreign to most people. But people are familiar with earthquakes, so we just use starquakes because that makes it a little bit easier. Because the field I actually study is called astroseismology, which sounds like a big word to most people and a very confusing word. But they tend to kind of know what seismology is, at least on the Earth, right? Where on the Earth, what happens is the plate tectonics, right? They smooch past each other, which has a little bit of energy. And that creates a wave in the planet, right? And we use those waves to tell us about what's going on inside the planet. Like, that's how we know that the center of the planet is probably molten and things like that. Mm-hmm. That's how we know what's going on inside, because we can't just drill a hole into the middle of the Earth. But we use the exact same physics of these waves traveling within the body on stars. But the thing is, this time, there's still waves within the star, right? So it's still seismology. And so we saw them star quakes because that's what people are most familiar with. But they aren't, of course, excited by plate tectonics in stars. There are a lot of different excitation mechanisms depending on what kind of star you're looking at, some of which are more like a heat engine and some of which are just from the surface is a convective layer. And so you have these... You know, like when you look at a pot of boiling ramen and there's these little cells that are spinning around, those also have energy just the same way that plate tectonics do. And so you can excite waves within a star with just those. I study the ones with convective surfaces predominantly. But yeah, that's kind of what they are. So starquakes is usually like I can tell that it came from a press conference kind of thing where it's astroseismology people who are like trying to explain the concept of waves within stars in a way that most of the public will actually be able to grasp.
Do all stars quake, or rather pulsate, in this way that you study?
That's a good question. The body of evidence that's coming out is seeming like maybe yes. A lot of stars actually do. The thing is that a lot of the oscillations that we measure, the waves, are really low amplitude, so they're really hard to detect. So on like the sun, the actual amplitude of the variations from these things are very, very small. But since the sun is so close, it's the best studied star ever. We can study those things that are really small. But for other stars that are like the sun, it's really difficult to measure those. You need a really nice high signal to noise space telescope, and you need really good space data with very little noise. But some of the bigger ones are way more obvious. So like Myra, for example, is the first ever discovered pulsating star, and its pulsations are like, what's a good scale of amplitude? It gets almost like 2 times bigger than it normally does. And so you can see that reflected in the brightness of the star. Okay, where was that? So Myra. Yeah. So Myra was the first one discovered. And it was, it was the first one discovered by Europeans, I'll say. And it gets really big. So it almost doubles in its size. And so you can see that reflected in the brightness of the star. And since it gets so big, it's a really large amplitude pulsation mode that we're able to see. And so there's a lot of the older ones, the ones we knew about for a long time, have these big amplitude pulsations, oscillations. But the newer ones that we're finding have a lot smaller amplitudes, which we're able to get because of new missions like Kepler and TESS and things like that. And so it seems like overall, it does seem like as we get more and more data, more better data, that everything, it seems like most stars are varying or oscillating in some kind of way.
Did you say Myra is doubling in size, the physically or the signal?
Physically, actually. So the pulsations that we see are an actual change in the size of the star, generally speaking. It's either going to change the size, so the radius, or it's going to change the temperature. Usually it will do both. But it's actually the stronger signal that we see is from changes in radius. So when we see the star is actually changing size, because there's basically pressure that's pushing on the outside of the star, and it's kind of moving like this. And when things are bigger, they're brighter. And when things are smaller, they're dimmer. But the effect is strange, right? Because actually when it's smaller, it's hotter. And when it's bigger, it's colder. So they're slightly opposite. They're competing effects, actually. So a bigger star is brighter, but a hotter star is also brighter. So you have like a, it's getting bigger and colder. So the bigger is winning, if that makes any sense. Bigger is winning over the temperature.
The, what is it? The Kappa mechanism is kind of like unintuitive. But I think probably what Benjamin was trying to figure out is that like, if the whole star is changing in size, like this is something that's happening on really short timescales compared to most other things that we observe in space, right?
Generally speaking. Yeah, so shorter than on an astronomical timescale, for sure. But there are many different timescales within pulsating stars. So the sun's characteristic timescale is like, what's 3,000 microhertz in days? A few minutes, I think. I think it's like a few minutes. So it's changing on size, but it's so small. That's that small amplitude thing, right? Where it's really small. It's not changing very much. But Myra, for example, Myra's variables are changing quite a bit, but they're changing on like 2-year time scales. So long to us, short to a star, but not as short as the sun.
It blows up to twice its size in 2 years and then back down to its original size in 2 years and then repeats?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I will say that it might not be exactly twice, but it's a big number. It's comparable to two. You know, astronomers, they don't know how numbers work. So two is the same as one, but like 10 is also kind of the same as two, but then also like five is zero. You know, all those kind of weird astronomer things.
I'm going to tell this to my kid who's having trouble in math class. But
just make it up. Once you're done, 3.14 is just one, and then you're good.
Yeah, see?
You can really upset any mathematicians listening by saying that physicists think that pi is approximately equal to e.
You know, we do whatever we can, I guess.
And so, yeah, you have stuff in between. Yeah, like Benjamin was saying, like you have this huge change happening periodically, and I think you have things like classic Cepheid variables or Delta Scuti stars, which on a scale of like days or even hours, these pulsations are happening.
Yep.
And so, like over the course of a single observation, you know, over a night, you can see just like the whole star just kind of expanding and contracting.
Yep. Yep.
Wild.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so the old detections too, so we do it with brightness these days, but you can also do it with radial velocity, right? And what you're actually measuring is the velocity of the star, the surface of the star as it's moving towards you, which is a really fascinating measurement if you think about it.
Ooh. Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, so that's how RV measurements work. So radial velocity, we're shortening to RV, but when you Delta Scuti's historically were predominantly studied in radial velocity before a while. But yeah, you measure the actual velocity of the star's surface changing as it moves towards you, because the only thing you ever measure in a star is the surface, right? So the only thing you ever see when you observe it is the surface. That's why we call it the photosphere, because that's where the light comes from.
Yeah.
That's the part we see. And so we can actually visualize, we can see that the velocity of that material moving towards us on a hour long-ish time scale.
Bananas.
Stars are weird, man. Stars are cool. Cool and weird.
That's the quote right there.
Stars are weird. Yeah, that's the name of the episode. Yeah, I had a friend the other night messaging me after a few too many drinks, and basically, like, her and her partner were just, like, rapid firing astronomy questions at me.
Oh, my brother does that.
That's an option? Okay. So, no.
Damn. Yeah. it was basically like my answer to everything just became, yeah, co-moving distances are weird. Neutron stars are weird.
Well, nuclear. My brother will get, like, he'll call me randomly and he's like, hey, this is a story that actually happened to me. So he called me. I'm in my PhD in Louisiana. He calls me and I'm just like, hello? And he's like, hey. And it's like 9 p.m. or something. And he's like, I just climbed a mountain and I'm like chilling at the top of the mountain and it's dark and I was looking at the stars and I thought I would call you. And then, you know, sometimes he just asked me a bunch of questions about quantum mechanics for like 2 hours. And then he asked me if I thought that stars or the universe had like a consciousness, which is apparently a thing people are talking about right now. And I was just like, Cody, I don't think we actually know the answers to these questions. you should ask a philosopher this question. I know
the stars aren't pulsating, they're just getting angry.
The PH in front of the PhD might mean philosophy, but I don't actually know that much. Well, actually I do know, but I don't know that kind of philosophy.
Wow. Yeah, those are some deep questions. I don't think anybody really knows.
No, but that's okay.
Okay, Benjamin, I know that you said that you had a big list of questions, so maybe we can do one more question and then we'll do an ad break.
All right, I'll do a fun question because we're going into probably a fun ad break. It's an observation one. It's a small one. It's a silly one. It's a syntax one. But what's the difference between astro and astero? Because...
God.
You get this? Do you hear this often? Because we spoke to an astrobiologist the other day.
I should have studied this.
Astero seismologist.
Oh, there's a reason. Actually, so this is a really funny thing that I actually know has a funny answer, but I can't recall it. Because I only know that I've heard Tim Bedding say the reason why this is. But I do know that the name was created like in our lifetimes by a guy who still works in the field. So the name astroseismology, the word, was created by this guy named Douglas Goff, who still publishes. And he still works. He actually recently published a new article where he made a joke in the title about astroseismology and its weird names that he came up with. Because he called it erythrogigantoseismology, which is the Latin beginning of word, whatever that word's called, prefix maybe, for red and giant. So it was red giant seismology, erythrogiganto. It was erythrogigantoacoustics. It was very strange. Anyway, I know that he came up with the word. And that he had a reason for picking the E, but I don't recall what it is. But it's just some guy decided to name it.
A little extra E.
Yeah, you just for some flavor. That. You gotta have a little flavor in your words.
E for extra. All right.
Just for that extra point in Scrabble.
Yeah, exactly. Can you even make astroseismology in Scrabble? I don't think the board is big enough. How many letters across is this gravel board?
I think it's 15 across, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, how many letters is astro-seismology?
Oh, please tell me the E is what keeps you from fitting on the board. That would make me so happy.
Oh, God.
It's 15 letters, I think. I just can't.
Exactly.
You can't fit it. But you got it.
I think you got it. Now I got to look at the Scrabble board. Okay.
Speaking of fun and games, I wanted to pause for a second to talk about our sponsor for this week and this season, actually, sciencesocks.com. I don't know if you are familiar with this wonderful website, Courtney.
No, I have never heard it. Please tell me more about Science Socks.
I mean, it's mostly what it sounds like. So sciencesocks.com sells like really cool science themed, especially space themed, or you could say astro themed.
Well, I wear socks.
But they also have jewelry and that's similarly themed. And there's like some really cool James Webb Space Telescope earrings and like a Keck telescope necklace and various socks and umbrellas and like super,
the umbrella I love. That's the JPL parachute with the
alternate. I've actually seen this website because I've seen the skirt. They have a skirt. They have a skirt of the JPL parachute and it's really cute.
Yeah, I feel like I was seeing, so Daniel from Science Talks, I was seeing his stuff around for a while and then actually connected with him on social media.
Nice.
Yeah, super cool guy, really cool product. And also, if you use the link sciencesocks.com/nerd, doesn't give you a discount or anything, but 10% of your purchase will go to a STEM charity, which I think is nice.
Yeah.
Right. So you can look classy and the kids can learn stuff. So it's awesome. Sciencesocks.com.
Yes.
Love it.
Sciencesocks.com/nerd. Yes, but back to the stars. I'm curious, like, was there a particular thing that led you down this path of like not just the pulsations in astroseismology in general, but like all of this wacky stuff that's happening with our Corona Borealis stars and hydrogen. What is it? It's hydrogen deficient carbon stars, right?
You're on it today, man. Like, you know all the terms. Yeah, that's right. So I mean, do you want to know about my life or do you want to know about my science?
Honestly,
how did your life lead you to science?
So I actually attribute my entire science career to the fact that I, as a child, was obsessed with the show MythBusters. Are you familiar?
Oh, wonderful.
Oh, I loved it. It was amazing. And I actually attribute most of my doing science to watching that show. I also loved How It's Made, but that was kind of just because I liked watching the machinery. But there was something that was like so cultural about MythBusters. And when I was a kid, what I really loved about it and what I love about it now looking back is that they... You know, when you do math and science in school, a lot of times your teachers or your friends or your family and stuff will just constantly tell you about how hard science and math, especially physics, is, right? And how it's really hard and you have to be really smart to do these things, right? But the thing that that show did so well was never say that. They never said any of that. All they ever said was that physics and science and all the stuff they were doing, the experimentation, was really fun and cool and interesting, right? So they framed everything from the lens of it being fun and it being cool and interesting that you can just figure out this stuff. And I think that was really formative for me because, you know, otherwise you just constantly get bogged down by everyone telling you that science is too hard to do and you would start to believe it yourself, right? That science is too hard and you would never be able to do it. And so I actually just think that MythBusters is the reason I do science. So I was really inspired by that and I was always interested in the stars. So I just kind of went that way. When I got to grad school, I was interested in stars still, and I was interested in mergers and various other things. But what actually happened was that I was hired to a department that didn't have, they had probably not enough professors for the amount of astronomy students that showed up at the time. And by that, I mean, they specifically didn't have enough money to hire, to have the PhD students like doing specific projects. And so I was kind of having a hard time finding a supervisor when I arrived, because in the US, you don't have a supervisor necessarily when you arrive a lot of the time. You just kind of do classes for 2 years and then you kind of figure it out. But you kind of want to figure it out like roughly in your first-ish year so that you can start working on the breaks between your classes. So I was actually in the office of a more senior PhD student. Her name was Kelsey. And I was just complaining about this, the fact that I couldn't find anyone to work with me on anything. And at LSU, at Louisiana State, where I did my PhD, the offices were like a suite. So there was an outer office, and then there were three little offices that came off of it. And Kelsey's office was one of those offices, but the other office was her supervisor's, Jeff. His name is Jeff Clayton. So Jeff heard our whole conversation, of course, me complaining. And like halfway through, he came and stood in the doorway, and he was like, "I got a project. Do you want to work on it?" And I was like, "Yes." That was how I actually started working with Jeff. So Jeff Clayton is like one of the main guys who worked on our Corona Borealis stars for a long time. He was one of the only people, one of the only people still alive that work on our Corona Borealis stars. There's really only a handful of us. I could probably name all of them. That's how I started working with him. And my first project was on our Corona Borealis stars, because he was like, "Oh, you're interested in mergers. These are post-merger stars." And then I just kind of went from there. So that's how I got started on Arcturus and HDCs, which are basically the same thing for a short version. But then the thing about them too is that they're also variable stars. And there's actually a lot of questions in the literature about what the variability is, or like what it looks like. Is it a pulsation? Because not every star that varies is pulsating, right?
Right.
Because pulsating specifically means that there is a standing wave that is excited within the star, and it needs to stay there. It needs to pulsate in that mode for some amount of time. It doesn't have to be super long, but it needs to have a standing wave. Sort of like when you strum a guitar string, right? Those are standing waves as well. It needs to have some kind of standing wave that's oscillating for a bit. But not all stars that vary in brightness have oscillations. And so there's a big question about this, but no one knew how to answer it because no one working on Arcturus had ever studied astroseismology. So I actually just applied to a postdoc that was in astroseismology here at UCID. And that's how I got started doing astroseismology. So the idea was always kind of to learn more about the field, more about oscillating stars, so that I can start to apply that back to the work I've already done on Arcturus and HDC stars. Huh. So that's my life story.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I can't wait for the Netflix miniseries.
I can mention what Arcturus and HDC stars are, by the way.
Yeah, maybe give a little bit of background for folks who aren't familiar.
Yeah, they're really cool stars. They're really interesting. Our Corona Borealis, the prototype star, was discovered in 1797 by some people who were looking at it with their eyes. And it's a naked eye star, so it's about fifth or sixth magnitude, maybe a binocular star. But they were looking at it with their eyes, and in the old days, you would just kind of look and write down what the brightness of stars were. And what they noticed is that one day it just disappeared from the sky. So it's a typically bright star, and then one day it was just gone. And then a few months later, it was back again, like the totally normal brightness. And they were like, what just happened? And they kept watching it for a while, and it didn't happen again for while they were observing it. Jump to many hundred years later, because there's always just a big gap in these observations. In the 1900s, when the Henry Draper catalog was running, when they were taking pictures of stars through that, I think it was are those the Harvard plates? Yeah, I think so. Some lovely women were looking at all of these stars, including one lovely Annie Jump Cannon, who looked at all of these plates from the Henry Draper catalog. And she went through and she measured the brightness of R. Corona Borealis, the star, and noticed that it was a 6-magnitude star, but sometimes it would just completely go away. It would just completely drop off, and then it would come back. And she could never predict when or why it happened, or how often it would happen, or how long it would last, because all those things were different every time. And she actually found quite a few stars like this. Later, they got some spectra of it, and they found that it didn't have any hydrogen lines. One, weird. And two, it was full of carbon molecules. So most stars are oxygen rich, so you see oxygen molecules if you see anything. But this star was weird because it had more carbon than oxygen, and so you saw carbon lines, carbon molecules in the spectrum. So they were like, oh. So that's actually where the term hydrogen deficient carbon star comes from. Cut to today, we know of about 200, roughly speaking, HDC stars, but we know also of two different kinds. One is like R. Corona Borealis. And R. Corona Borealis, the reason that it goes away sometimes is because it's a really big, fluffy star. And near the surface of the star, just a little bit of it like kind of comes off. And it forms dust, so it condenses into this cold dust cloud, and it blocks the star, actually just eclipses the star fully, just completely obscures it from the line of sight. And then the dust moves out, and eventually it becomes like thin, right? When it moves away, it thins out, and eventually you can see the star again. But we can't predict when or why or how or where the dust is being formed around the star. There are also HDC stars which don't emit dust, which raises yet another question of why do the ones that emit dust have dust? And then the ones, like what? Why do some have dust and some don't? These are actually just super unanswered questions, and we still don't know, but we do kind of have an idea. Actually, we don't have any ideas as to why they don't do that, but we're trying our best, if you will. We know a few things, and just recently, like within the past 5 years, we've discovered a lot more stars. Like that's the 200 number, actually. So before, probably 10 years ago, there were maybe only 50 known, and now we know of about 200 because of the work of my collaborator Patrick in Paris. So we know of quite a few more now, and so we can finally start doing some real like population studies where we can start to see what's actually different between these two different types of stars. But what we also think, the second interesting thing is there's a big question that's deep within the spectra, which is where'd the hydrogen go? And why is it carbon rich? That's actually two really weird things for a star. And so what we think is happening and what we've been able to model is that after stars die, they form white dwarfs. And so if you have two white dwarfs, which are in a binary system, and they're really close together, they can spin up and they can merge. So what happens is that the littler one just kind of forms a shell around the bigger one. By bigger, I mean mass, so the bigger mass one. It forms a shell around it, and that shell is not so compact as the white dwarf. But also when it goes on to the white dwarf, it heats up quite a bit, especially at the base. So what you essentially have is a shell of burning material, hot burning material, and then a big envelope on top. Well, structurally, that's the same as a red giant, actually. And so what happens is the star expands really big, becomes a really big star, even though it's a really low mass. So it's only about a one solar mass star, but it's about 150 to 100 stellar radii, bigger than most giants. And since they are already evolved stars, the white dwarfs, they already have no hydrogen. Right. And from all of our measurements, we can tell that the stars, the HTC stars, have less than 1% hydrogen by mass. Compare that to a typical star, which has 75% hydrogen by mass, for example. So our stars are 98% helium, 1% carbon, and then 1% everything else. They're really weird stars. You got the double white dwarf merger thing, and you got the dust thing, and you got the pulsations, and you got the weird opacities and all that fun junk. So they're really cool and interesting stars, but they're quite, you have to kind of know a lot of different stuff to be able to study them in detail, which is why things have stalled for so long, because you need a lot of intersectionality of different fields to really get at the meat of what's happening here. And since there were so few known for so long, we didn't really know how to tackle that, I guess. Only just now are we starting to really build that up, build the field back up again.
That's so awesome. How one star literally wears another star.
Well, it's also just interesting.
Very Hannibal Lecter kind of star.
Yeah, when we talk about stars too, we always talk about like the single star life cycle. But it's so interesting to think about the fact that there's a whole second. The two stars are getting a whole second life as a new star, right? Mm-hmm. So after they merge together, they become one new star with its own new life cycle that we just never really consider or think about. We never think about, I mean, we do, a lot of people think about merged stars, but we don't really think about how they evolve. We just think about the merger, what happens in the merger, but we don't often think about what happens after. They merge, unless it's an explosion, of course.
That's exactly what I was thinking, because like you're talking about a merger of two white dwarfs. I'm assuming that the combined mass has to be less than the mass limit for a 1A supernova, right?
Exactly.
Because otherwise, you could just have them crashing into each other and exploding.
Exactly. Yep. So these are what we sometimes call in like proposals when we want money. Is we call them the low mass type 1As. So they're low mass type 1A supernovae in that they don't supernova at all. But yeah.
Yeah.
Same exact mechanism, but just the lower mass. So what happens when you don't explode? You actually just make a new star. It's kind of cool.
That's so cool. And it's so cool to me that I didn't realize this, that you basically like spend all of this time working on astroseismology just to understand why that's not the cause for what you're seeing.
Well, the thing is, I don't know, it might be. I've worked on it a little bit. It's really hard, actually. The problem with trying to do pulsations in arcivores especially is that you have to get rid of the dust. So when we study pulsating stars, we use the light curve. So we use the brightness of the star. And the thing is that if you put a bunch of dust in front of the star, you can't see it for a while, and you don't know how long that's going to last. Our Corona Borealis has a famous decline. In 2007, it went into decline for 12 years. We didn't see it for 12 years. And so for 12 years, you just can't see the star. And those are sort of random and different lengths. And that means that the light curve, the brightness of the star, the thing that we actually measure to look for pulsations, is really hard to study with traditional techniques. So things like a fast Fourier transform, which you would use for normal stars, any kind of Fourier method, don't work so well when you have gaps in your data. It just tends to look ugly. So we have to come up with creative new techniques in order to study the pulsations of these stars. That's part of what's made it so difficult, is that they might only pulsate. They might only oscillate a few times when we can see them before they go dim again. And then we can't tell if they would have continued pulsating or anything like that.
What tools do you need to use to observe these pulsating stars? I think you use Kepler or anything else or in ground based telescopes?
So for most people, we'll just use Kepler and TESS because that's going to be the best data. The problem is if you actually want to study a bright star, that Kepler and TESS are not so good. Kepler and TESS are made to study dim stars because dim stars are hard to study from the ground, but they're not very good with bright stars. So if you care about bright stars, you actually don't have very many options. You tend to want to observe from the ground, but that does mean that you're susceptible to higher noise levels. For the Arcturus, there's actually this really interesting thing that maybe you guys know about, which is the American Association of Variable Star Observers.
ABSO, yeah, of course.
The AAVSO is a lovely, lovely organization, and our Corona Borealis is one of the most well-studied stars on AAVSO because it's interesting, right? So if you're an amateur astronomer or someone who just likes looking at stars, you can, if you have a telescope or even with your eyes, just go outside, look at Arcturus, say, how bright is it? And then put your measurement onto this database, the AAVSO. And since it often goes into decline randomly and we don't really know what it's going to do at any time, people love looking at it. And a lot of the bright Arcturus people really like looking at. So they're actually really well studied in AAVSO. So the light curve we have from there for Arcturus is like 225 years long, starting from 1797, right? Because it actually has the data from 1797, and it has soon it will have the plates from the Annie Jump Cannon study as well, which would be really interesting. So we use pretty much anything we can find. Sometimes when you do astronomy, it's kind of like data scavenging. You just kind of like scourge around on the internet and you're like, oh, you got three data points for me? That's cool. I'll take that. And then you just like put it in your data folder, and then you go look for three more data points, and then eventually you build up a data set. But we kind of just use whatever we can. Whatever's out there, whatever observed it, anytime, we try to use them.
This is so wild, and I feel like we could talk about solving these mysteries for hours, but I know that we have some a tight deadline coming up, so we're going to jump quickly to our rapid fire questions round, if that's okay.
Sounds good.
Yeah. All right. The first question, which might be a bit ironic given your passion for Mythbusters, is what was the weirdest thing that you believed as a kid?
When I was very small, I have a distinct memory of my mom asking me what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I said, a butterfly.
There you go. That's awesome.
I think I was three. I don't remember. I just remember saying it. But now I'm like, that's stupid.
No, that's awesome. Which teacher had the biggest positive impact on you?
I've suddenly forgotten every teacher I have ever had. So everyone's going to say their English teacher in high school, but I'm going to also say my English teacher in high school. She was great. Her name was Miss Watts. Cause I had her for like 3 years cause she just kept moving up with us. But she was really good. And something she did in the English class was have us write an essay about what we wanted, where we wanted to go to college and what job we wanted to get, and like actually look up colleges and write down and make a plan basically of what we were going to do. When we graduated from high school, and I actually followed that plan pretty closely. I think she said she messaged me and said she still uses it because she's all proud of it, because I said I was going to be an astronomer in it, and then I actually am an astronomer, so that's kind of cute.
Really sweet. Wow, shout out to Ms. Watts. Okay, what is one scientific discovery that you wish you could have witnessed in person?
Maybe not a discovery, but I'd love to have seen 87A. Supernova 1987A.
Yes.
I'd love to see a supernova happen. It's due any time now.
Yeah, any minute. It's meant to be every 100 years, roughly, right?
Galaxy. It's any minute now for the next 100 years.
And now.
You can set your watch to it.
Exactly.
If you had to pick one historical scientist to go bowling with, who would it be?
Annie Jump Cannon.
Did you think? Love it.
I feel like, yeah, there was like a microsecond between question and answer.
She's great, man. I love all those. I love that the 1900s are such a funny time because that was when astronomy was still considered clerical, so they made all the women do it. So all the discoveries in that time are from women, which I think is really cool. Not cool for the misogyny reasons, but like just kind of cool now because you're like, look at all these discoveries from women.
Yeah, I'm constantly like frustrated by having to describe things like the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, which are named after a bunch of dudes, even though all the work was done by, you know, people like Annie Jump Cannon, Henrietta Swan Leavitt, Cecilia Payne-Gaposchkin. Yeah.
Yep.
That would be a whole bowling team. There you go.
There you go. We'd be the best bowling team ever. We'll call us the Arcona Borealis Stars.
Love that. Okay. This is a very serious question. If you were a sandwich, what kind of sandwich would you be?
Hot dog.
Whoa. Hot dogs. Everybody knows that a hot dog is a taco.
Oh.
This is my most. I'm being canceled. You don't want me on this talk on this show anymore.
You know, if you didn't want the answers, we shouldn't ask them. But
you said it was very serious, man. I'm giving you my serious answer. Yep. Hot dog.
Okay. Fair enough.
Ketchup only.
I'm trying to get the energy to ask the next question. Like a hot dog. It's a sandwich. Moving on. What is your most controversial opinion about pizza?
I love pineapple on pizza, man. I'm a pineapple on pizza lover.
Yes.
I love pineapple. But I also am a thin crust lover. I think a lot of people like big, like puffy crust. I don't know. Thin crust all the way. I want it to like crunch when you bite it.
Mm-hmm. Here for it. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Okay, what is your favorite scientific phrase or scientific word?
Maybe know thy star, know thy planet. Something that I say all the time, which I think is neat. So this isn't even relevant to me, but when you're studying exoplanets, for example, which a lot of people around me are, you have to know the star in order to know the exoplanet. If you don't know anything about the star, you don't know anything about the exoplanet. And it's just kind of a nice phrase to say, I think. Hmm. Know thy star, know thy planet. In fact, I just had a conference recently about exoplanets, which was called Know Thy Star.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's awesome. What is your least favorite scientific word or phrase?
My least favorite? God, there's so many to choose from. there's truly so many horrible ones. There's some horrible terms that don't make any sense, like planetary nebulas that don't form planets. There's also like the entire concept of magnitudes. Why does the scale go backwards? That is horrible. There's so many. Probably those two, I guess. Those are the ones I think about the most often. Because when I teach stellar astronomy to like undergrads, and they're like, "Why does it go backwards?" And I'm like, "I don't know."
Honestly, yeah. Okay, what is your favorite useless science fact?
Useless.
Yeah.
Something
that you know that you think is like really, really fun, but practically it's just useless.
So I used to have pet rats. And something fun about rats is that they have some of the biggest balls of any creature in the world. relative to their size. Am I allowed to say that?
100%. 100% allowed.
I feel like people... I have like a really weird memory where like I don't remember things that I need to remember, but I remember like really random things. And I just know the moment you said that, I'm like, this is going to live rent-free in my head
forever. I'm going to go tell it to people today.
You should look up a picture of rats. You'll notice.
No, something. I don't need to. I just thought the fact will do. If you could rename one planet in our solar system, what would you call it?
Oh, this is... I actually just like all the planets. Is that a bad answer? I just think they're nice. No. Even the planet everyone hates, Uranus, which I will pronounce correctly, is actually one of my favorite planets. So you can't rename it. It's my friend. His rings are this way, which is cool. And he's been the wrong way.
He's doing his best.
I actually have a plushie of Uranus out in my main room, which I would have shown you, but you know, oh well.
Oh, next time. Okay, last question. You've made it through, but the final question is, if you had to sing one karaoke song to save humanity from an alien invasion, what would that karaoke song be?
Well, I wouldn't save humanity in that case because I wouldn't do karaoke. But if you really want an answer, it would have to be a song from Hamilton the musical. And not I did have a big Hamilton phase, okay? It's kind of embarrassing, but it's just because the songs are really memorable and rhythmic to me, and I can never forget them. They're just in my head forever. So I would be actually kind of good at remembering how the song went.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's fair. I guess you need to like not sing well, but like just to know all the words and the rhythm. That's probably an important thing.
Basically, it's like kind of like rapping with a little bit of singing.
True.
I mean, my in-car karaoke Hamilton the musical is very good. It's a one-man show.
With great acoustics.
Yes.
Courtney, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your patience with all of our silly questions.
No worries.
If folks want to get in touch with you or follow your work, where would be a good place for them to look you up?
I'm really not super active on anything. So I have a Blue Sky that people can follow. I must admit, I don't really use it that much. Maybe one day I will. So that's probably the best place.
Cool. Fair enough. Benjamin, what about you? Where can the good people find you?
You can find me anywhere on all the social media platforms. If you just look for Science Actually. Facebook's the biggie, but Science Actually is pretty much on all of them. Instagram, Threads, Twitter, etc., etc., etc. How about you, Kavi? Where are you?
I am in Sydney. I am. You can find me on all of the good social media platforms and also the bad ones. I don't spend a lot of time on either really these days, but you can find me at Fun Fact Science on all of them. And you can find our show, The Nerd and the Scientist, on YouTube and TikTok and Spotify and wherever you get your podcasts from. Feel free to reach out to us if you have any questions about the content on our show, or if you want to suggest some guests for us or things that we should include in future episodes.
We'd love to hear it.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right. And we will see you all next time on the next episode of Science Actually Presents The Nerd and the Scientist.
Bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.
pick it up. Shake it up.